Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast dedicated to climbing the greasy pole. My name's Corey Hazelest, and my partner in propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hey, Corey.
Controversially, Not Enough Champagne is breaking its no alcohol rule, not because we're talking about Donald Trump, you'll be pleased to know, but because there's a local election campaign on, and it's forced us both to drink. This is the first podcast of a little mini-series we're going to have over the next month or two, looking at the local elections. And we're hoping to speak to prospective candidates, and we'll hopefully be analysing the results in depth after it happens on May the 3rd, with hopefully a few Labour gains in Birmingham as well. This one is on political ambition, because our politicians don't look like us, and the politicians that we will elect in May won't look representative of the wider society they're representing either. There'll be too many men, they'll be too white, there'll be too many who were university educated or who went to private schools. That unrepresentativeness, that's bad for representative democracy, but it's also bad for decision making as well, because the research suggests that the best decisions are made by diverse groups. So are our politicians unrepresentative because of differing levels of political ambition? There's a report from Bath University, which is the first systematic study of political ambition in Britain, and that might have some answers. We'll find out if it does after this. So the first major takeaway, Steve, I got from this report is that 10,000 people were asked if they'd ever seek political office or if they'd rule it out completely. And only 10% of people say that they would seek political office. So already, 90% of people seem to be ruling themselves out of seeking any form of political office, which can't be great for our democracy, can it?
No, it does suggest that there's some problems that need to be overcome here. The fact that only 10% of people would, on first asking, consider it, suggests that there are a number of barriers somewhere along the way that need to be broken down so that we can ensure we have as representative as cadre of elected officials as possible across all different areas of government. That study does also show is that when you break it down further, people are more open to standing as a local councillor than they are as an MP, but the fact that only 10% of people would be, you know, on the first asking, would be willing to serve as even just a local councillor is a massive problem in terms of, not just in terms of being representative, but drawing in talent. Because if you've got a very narrow pool of applicants for positions like that, then you're not necessarily going to have the best people there.
The interesting thing is that those applicants, by the looks of things, tend to come from a particular group, don't they? And the report does list a few specific groups that these politically ambitious people tend to come from.
Yeah, absolutely. So according to this report by Bath University, men are more ambitious than women. No big surprise there, I feel, to be quite honest, but I believe it was almost by a 2-to-1 margin.
Well, yeah, so 14% of men said they were likely to stand rather than 7% of women.
Yeah.
I'm guessing it's more because of overconfident hubris as much as anything else.
Yeah, that toxic masculinity coming back in some form as ever. The more educated you are, the more ambitious you are likely to be. Again, I suspect that probably reflects a higher level of political engagement more than anything else.
Hmm.
North-South divide was quite interesting. If you're in the South, you are more likely to be politically ambitious than you are if you are in the Midlands or the North.
I wonder if that's because the further you get from London, the more remote politics seems, or certainly Westminster politics seems.
Yeah, I think there's something to that. But that doesn't necessarily explain why only 10% of people would be willing to consider being a local councillor, for instance, though. So there's clearly other elements there as well. One of the other points that I found quite interesting was the breakdown of basically personality types. Perhaps not unsurprisingly, people who were confident and more comfortable with the unknown were more politically ambitious. Confidence in politicians or politically ambitious people makes sense. You can totally see why you would need to be confident to put yourself out there onto somebody's doorstep and say, come vote for me, I'm amazing, which is essentially what you need to do. Being comfortable with the unknown is quite interesting, though, because that's one of those traits which you would expect to be more associated with, you know, certain political ideologies. Comfort with the unknown, maybe being something a bit more left-wing than you know, some of the traditionalist right-wing views. And yet, seemingly, there's no real discrepancy between individuals who are left-wing or right-wing on these sorts of things. So that I found quite interesting. Unsurprisingly, again, based on levels of political engagement, if you're upper class, if you're middle class, basically you're A, B, or C1, you're more likely to be politically engaged than your C2s and below. And I think the final thing, really, from my perspective that was particularly interesting was that the more involved your parents were in politics, and this study was looking at things in terms of not just, you know, being an MP or being a councillor or whatever, but also being a trade union rep, or you know, a member of a union and things like that. The more involved your parents are, the more ambitious you are as well when it comes to politics. So I think what we're looking at here is essentially a almost a cultural divide, which I think really boils down to the level of engagement that somebody has. Because if you're engaged with politics, chances are you're following it quite closely, which means you're probably going to get angry about something, or you're going to look at it and go, we need to do this better, we need to change this, we need to focus on this sort of area, which is the sort of thing which ultimately gets you to make that decision to run. Because at the end of the day, politics is about enacting change. And if you don't think that change can happen, you're not going to run. Whilst if you do, you're much more likely to get involved and much more likely to make that stand.
I think it's partly that. I think it's also the development of a political class aspect as well, isn't there? So there are a couple of political dynasties in Britain at the moment. I mean, I think maybe the most obvious one is Hilary Benn, whose father Tony was something in the Labour Party, I forget what exactly. Seb Corbyn, who's Jeremy's son, is John McDonnell's chief of staff. And obviously there's David and Ed Miliband, and their father was a Marxist academic and politico. So you can see why there would be this development of political families.
Yeah, you can see why that becomes a thing, and that's something which you can see certainly in the United States as well. The Kennedys are the big one, or were the big one. These days, not so much, but you've still got the Bushes. You've still got the Pauls in the form of Rand and Ron. You know, you may have one in the form of the Obamas, if Michelle Obama decides to throw her hat into the ring at some point, which is something which is talked up fairly often, but doesn't seem to have much basis in fact currently.
And I suppose it's part of the professionalisation of politics, in that it's becoming more like a job and a career you enter into. And I suppose if your dad does that particular job, or your mum does that particular job, you're probably more likely to go into it or see that it's worthwhile, or think, yeah, I could do that, my dad did that, I don't mind doing that.
Yeah, I mean, one of the aspects of the study that we haven't touched on yet was that there was a correlation between people who have low levels of trust in democracy and politicians and politics as a whole being less ambitious when it comes to you know, getting involved in politics. So I think it is almost about that normalisation of kind of like politics as activity rather than politics that's something that happens around you. If you normalise it and make it a part of somebody's life and a part of their structure and their system, you know, they're much more likely to look at it as, you know, just something that's normal. And as such, you know, they're going to get more involved with it because it's something that's just a part of their life.
And it's needing to see the worth of politics and see the worth of democracy as well, isn't it? If you have the attitude of, is it the old Ken Livingstone quip that however you vote, the government still gets in? If you have that attitude and don't think that democracy matters much, you're not going to bother seeking office, because what is the point? Whereas if you think actually elections can change things, then you are more likely to try and seek office.
Yeah, and again, that boils back down to the fact that you need to have, in some way, that driving principle that makes you think, I want to change this. you know, oh, I want to achieve this. There's a core set of beliefs or something which you can tap into, which will form the foundation of your political stances. And even the most kind of swingy and hypocritical of politicians do have this to a degree. I'm thinking particularly here of like Boris Johnson. And if they've got that kind of core set of beliefs, it gives them a reason to actually get involved and get into the fray. If they don't have that, then why bother? What's the point?
I suppose with Boris Johnson, the core set of beliefs is in himself.
Boris Johnson, yeah.
Yeah, which I suppose we're gone full circle into why people are getting involved. One thing we haven't talked about is the educational aspect of this, and I suppose class as well, but I'm guessing probably class maybe fits into the educational aspect of it. And we have talked about how education and levels of education is one of those big dividing lines in terms of how you vote, in terms of the Brexit referendum, in terms of the general election result. And again, I feel I need to point out that just because you're more educated and more likely to have voted Remain doesn't necessarily mean you're more intelligent. But I wonder with the education aspect, if it's that a lot of politicians will get their start at university. So there's not only university guild of students elections, it's part of the networking that you get at university and the connections you make. If you are a regular listener, you will have heard probably Luke John Davis talk about this slightly, is political parties are tending to, rather than be staffed by people from trade unions, they tend to be staffed from young, say, young Labour or young Conservatives. And so that university politics scene is becoming more and more important as a way of finding talent. And so I wonder if that's why education is a very, very big factor in why people end up standing to vote as well.
I think that's part of it, but I also think there's just the fact that it really just boiled down to the culture in which you grow up. There's a wonderful anecdote which comes, I think, from, it was one of the Freakonomics books. And one of the things that they point out is that there is a correlation between the number of books that somebody has growing up in their house and their overall level of educational achievement. Now, actually, when you strip that back down to its core thing, it's all about the level of education that the mother in that family has. And I think it's a very similar thing here. If you exist in a household which is heavily engaged with politics, which is more likely to be the case if your parents are university educated, and we know for a fact that if your parents are university educated, you are more likely to go to university. You've just grown up in that structure, in that system, and it becomes a much more normalised concept for you that you need to get involved in this in some way.
One thing I thought was interesting from the study is that race isn't necessarily a big factor in terms of a measurement of political ambition. I mean, I suppose we should say in terms of the survey, it's more that the survey wasn't statistically significant. So there's a 0.5% difference in terms of the ambition of those from a white family and those from a non-white family. But the sample is too small to tell. But in the US, certainly, race is ethnicity is a barrier to entering politics. It's interesting that doesn't quite seem to be the case here.
So I think there's two elements to that. So, and this is probably where you can draw some quite significant distinctions between the US and the UK. In the US, you probably do have a much more overt race in and of itself being a problem, either because there genuinely do exist or there are perceptions in certain communities that you won't get elected, or there's no, if you're a black person, you won't be able to be successful if you're not white, because racism is a massive problem in the US, and certainly in certain parts of the country, you know, there are genuinely towns where you could not win an election because of the colour of your skin. For the UK, this is not to say that racism isn't an issue in the UK, it is in a lot of ways still, but I think it boils down to more to do with class than anything else. Ultimately, ethnic minorities tend to fall, for the most part, there are exceptions, into the C2 and below categorisations when we talk about class. This is basically just down to the fact that they don't earn enough money and they don't have the same educational opportunities that a lot of white people do have. As a result of that, you end up, I suspect, kind of combining the two things. But you need to look at it at class at the same time as well, because ultimately everything seems to boil down to that those kind of class barriers and those class values that exist.
Yeah, so I think that's interesting. And maybe we can try and just spend the rest of this looking at maybe possible solutions. in terms of solving anyway the turnout problem and maybe trying to get people to see the worth of democracy and voting, actually maybe the referendum seemed to do that, because what you did see is a lot of people from those C2 and DE class backgrounds, or from backgrounds who don't have necessarily a high level of formal education, actually, because it was a referendum and there's a clear choice and it's obvious your vote will count, a lot of people did turn out and vote in that referendum that didn't then turn out in the general election. And that's been one of the factors that explains the Corbyn surge and the fact the Tories lost their overall majority. So some form of democratic reform is a way of trying to break down these barriers, but I suppose we'd have to see these equivalent surveys in countries that do have a proper voting system.
Yeah, I suspect actually voting system in and of itself probably doesn't come down to having a massive impact on this. If you look at countries which have proportional representation, which whenever we talk about voting systems, we're talking about, you know, making a change to PR in some form. They've all got PR in some form, and yet they still have that level of discontent with the political system. I mean, Germany is a classic example of this. The left-wing SPD are now currently being, I believe, outpolled by the AfD, the Alternative for Deutschland, who are basically neo-Nazis. The rise of the True Finn Party in Finland and across a lot of different countries, you still have the rise of these populist groups who are anti the establishment. Mm. That it's a trend which is happening everywhere, which makes me think that I don't think it's about the electoral system. I think it might have more to do with the notion of where power lies and can be seen to lay. I think you are very right when you highlighted that with the Brexit referendum, you know, more people came, well, you know, it's a fact that more people from less politically engaged backgrounds came out and voted. And I think you hit onto something when you said it makes it look like it matters. But I think it's also because it was directly in their hands. I do wonder if you were to try and just encourage more indirect democracy through voting for representatives and things like that, if you would be able to actually encourage that same kind of engagement. Because ultimately, in a representative democracy, you're not saying your voice matters, you're saying this person's voice that you're electing matters. And I think that could be the difference there that would drive differential turnout in a normal election versus a Brexit versus a referendum.
Mm. And not wanting to go down the reform rabbit hole, yeah, because we'll be here for a long while. But then maybe some way of deliberative democracy, or some way of a citizens' convention, or one way of putting it, is a way of trying to get a little bit of engagement in issues that might actually matter.
It would be interesting to look at Switzerland as a case study for that, because Switzerland as a country has a lot more direct democracy in it than an awful lot of Western countries in general, definitely, and certainly than most of Europe, which I think could make it a nice baseline to compare against. I don't know if an equivalent report has been done in Switzerland, but that's the sort of thing we would need to look at to try and determine if it is a case of, is it the system? Is it the principle that it's you know, the individual's voice versus the representative voice or whatever? That's what you'd need to look at. I think one of the really interesting things about the report that Bath University put out, highlighted, was that, you know, there have been a number of attempts to try and make parliamentary chambers more accessible. In both Scotland and Wales, at the Assembly and the Scottish Parliament, they've brought in changes such as more flexible hours, they've brought in childcare provisions, all of which are good things in and of their own right, with the idea being, you know, this should make it more accessible to, I think in this instance, primarily women was the driving force here. And the reality is, when you look at the breakdowns of the statistics for this, there's no difference in terms of political ambition, by gender, for instance, between Wales, Scotland and England. Even though Wales and Scotland have taken direct policy and process changes to try and make themselves more appealing. It's not just a case of that there are physical barriers and limitations. There is clearly something wider and more cultural that needs to be addressed there. If it's not policy that can overcome this, what is it that can overcome this lack of political ambition?
One thing the report mentions is that one thing that's led to this cultural shift, this cultural disconnect, is that decline of the union movement. So it used to be that those people from working class backgrounds, like Alan Johnson, like John Prescott, rose into parliament through the union movement. That's not really happening much anymore. As I say, the shift has been more to universities and then looking to young Labour, young Conservatives for political recruitment. And that's not just true in Britain. That seems to be true across Europe as well. One thing the report mentions is that maybe momentum could lead to some sort of mini revival in the range of people that are thinking of running. And actually, it was interesting. A few people at my local Labour meeting yesterday were talking about Alex Nunn's The Candidate book about Jeremy Corbyn. And something that I'd kind of forgotten but hadn't really joined the dots on is that if you look at the person who started a petition to try and get a left-wing Labour candidate on the ballot, which started, I think, got a few hundred thousand signatures and started the kind of shift of MPs nominating Corbyn. That was woman, not particularly politically engaged before. If you look at the person who put together one of the first memes about Jeremy, which was the picture of him in the 80s protesting about apartheid outside the South African embassy, which you see all the time now. Again, that was a woman, not particularly involved in politics before. And so actually, there are quite a few, and anecdotally I know from Momentum in Birmingham as well, it has been a bit of a vehicle for getting women who weren't previously involved in politics involved and engaged. So I think that is potentially, organisations like Momentum are a way of trying to get candidates through from backgrounds who probably didn't consider themselves political with a capital P before.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right there with that analysis, but I think it boils down to one real core fact as to why that's the case. It's because Momentum, when it first started off, was not part of the Labour Party. It was a separate organisation. It was basically just the Jeremy Corbyn for Leader campaign, and it was aiming to find people and recruit them, obviously, to get involved with the campaign. But you could be a member of Momentum without being a member of the Labour Party. That isn't the case anymore. But it does mean that you can't get engaged with it, particularly, if at all, without putting your hand up and saying, I'm a Labour person. Now, chances are, if you are engaged with Momentum, you're going to be a Labour person in some capacity. But what it means is that you can't, you have to make that next level of commitment. You have to turn around and say, okay, I'm going to pay however much it is a year to pick up that Labour membership card. For a lot of people, a psychological barrier. Once they're in it, they're fine. But you need to have a way to encourage people to take that initial first step. And I think what you would need to look at there is the way that political parties position membership. Because at the moment, it's pretty much all or nothing. You're either a member or you're not. And that means you either have the complete benefits, you get to choose all of the candidates, or you get to do nothing. Other than, you know, get to receive some emails if you put yourself on a membership list, where you will receive begging emails for money, or occasionally get given some door knocking and leaflets shoved through your door. So what I think political parties would probably need to look to do is find a way that they can extend the way that they can reach out to regular people who aren't necessarily as politically engaged as party members are. Obviously with the aim of making them engaged so that they can become members and then ultimately become activists and ultimately get them to stand. But really, that involves taking a good, long, hard look at how political parties are structured. Because if people have got that psychological block of membership, whether it's because they look at it and go, well, I don't agree with them on 100% on everything. Which, you know, if you're listening to this and you're not a member of a political party and you've ever had that thought, that should never stop you from joining, because chances are there's not a single person in any political party who agrees 100% with what that party kind of talks about and is in that manifesto. And I would include both of the leaders of the main parties in that.
Well, I think about people like Roy Hattersley, who over the past 40 years has morphed from being one of the leading figures on the Labour right to being one of Tony Blair's main left-wing critics, to then being part of the right again without really ever changing his views on anything. It just depends on where the wind blows.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't think it should be an all or nothing. You're a member or you're not. Various points we've had, there have been discussions in Labour for associate membership. The Tories have talked about similar things and have run things like open primaries where Sarah Williston down in, I think it's Totnes, the MP for Totnes, was selected by an open primary of just local residents and did very, very well out of it. It has the potential to just enable more people to get engaged with it. Now, that does mean you would need to tweak what people can and cannot engage with. You may very well want to make it so that only fully paid up members get to choose MPs, for instance, or get to choose who will be the candidates for general elections. But why couldn't an associate member come along to the selection meeting for the local council? There are lots of arguments, to be honest, based on cost and practicality against open primaries. They're good things to try and aim for, but they're just not practical. Associate membership, where you are opening it up to specific people who don't want to make the full commitment, but, you know, it gives you a chance to start that conversation with them, gives them some kind of benefit, and then you can bring them into the fold. And once you've brought them in, that's when you can get them to start thinking about running. Because ultimately, political parties are the main vehicle for somebody becoming a candidate and actually having a chance at winning an election in this country. And as such, they need to do something and change to bring about more political ambition in the underrepresentative demographics from society.
There's a lot to unpack there in terms of affiliate membership of a party. It used to be the case that in Labour there were various affiliate members who did make up a third of the electoral college. So it used to be, if you remember the Fabian Society, for instance, you got a vote in the Labour leadership election. That got scrapped partly because you ended up with people like Harriet Harman who got 7 votes, and also because, as you might recall, Eric Joyce punched someone in the Westminster bar, so the Labour right decided, ooh, let's change the leadership rules and we'll make it like the French Socialist Party, their primary system, and they had a system like that where you could pay a small amount of money and 1 million people voted for the French Socialist candidate for president. And the upshot of all of that is that the French Socialist Party has collapsed and Jeremy Corbyn is Labour leader, neither of which is probably what the Labour right was intending to do when they actually set up that process in the first place. Certainly, I think on the Tory side, I don't think open primaries are going to happen anymore. You mentioned cost, you mentioned practicality. It's also the fact that actually you elect MPs like Sarah Williston, while they're very, very good, they're also very independent, and the whips don't like that very much. In terms of Labour, any debate on members, on associate members and how they elect an MP is inevitably going to be rolled into any debate about deselection or mandatory reselection. Certainly in Britain, unlike America, there isn't really a tradition of a primary system. But it'll be interesting to see if there is much of a move towards that, given the democracy review in the party that's coming up that I think Katie Clark is running at the moment, and given the fact that the section of the party in the far left who have genuinely been in favour of reselection are in charge of the leadership and the NEC and now the general secretary position as well. Certainly in the current context of the Labour debate, any move to allowing associate members to vote for candidates or for leaders is going to have massive pushback within the party because of the stuff that's happened previously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I wouldn't disagree with that. But what I would say is that momentum has been the shock to the system in a lot of ways that the Labour Party needed. It was an influx of new members and an influx of activists. More, if you don't know any better, they're all a bunch of trots who are trying to take over the Labour Party. They aren't. Most of them are just ideological people who are relatively new to politics, who've never been members of political parties before, who saw something in Jeremy Corbyn which was different to everything else. What you're not going to see without some form of way to engage people that doesn't involve full membership is a repeat of that come the next leadership election, whenever that is. Because ultimately, you need to be able to drive engagement and make it look interesting. And that is best served by making sure that you have leadership candidates themselves who are very representative of Britain, to put it quite bluntly. It's going to be very difficult for anybody to get excited about yet another white middle-class bloke running for Labour leader.
That's my chances dashed then.
I know, I'm sorry, Corey. But again, when you look at all of the people who are being talked up as potential successors to Corbyn, you know, they're all coming from underrepresented groups. So you've got a number of different women, and you've got a number of ethnic minority MPs. You've got LGBT MPs as well. So really, it's a bit of a chicken and egg situation. But the easiest way to kind of solve that problem is to offer people an opportunity to get involved. And yeah, it opens up a can of worms for Labour. It opens up a can of worms for the Tories and the Lib Dems. It opens up a can of worms for everyone, because none of the parties are structured to deal with it. They need to get over that, because I think the first party that actually does is going to reap some serious electoral benefits.
That seems like a nice note to end on. We'll have a few episodes on over the next few weeks in the run-up for local elections, in between me door-knocking and sobbing silently in the corner, rocking side to side. And we'll be talking, hopefully, to potential candidates. We'll be trying to do a little bit of number crunching the results. No doubt talking about the latest outrageous thing that's happened in Brexit news as well. You can read any other stuff that we put out on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/notenoughchampagne. Our website is notenoughchampagne.com, and our Twitter page is @nochampagnepod. My personal Twitter handle is paperbackwriter.
Mine's @centreradical.
And James Cram designed our logo. No, he didn't. James, yes, he did. Dave Depper is responsible for our theme tune. Happy plotting, everyone.